This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. You know we're on Twitter at KUOW. Big news today nationwide and in Washington State. The information superhighway gets a toll lane. President Trump's FCC voted just hours ago to end net neutrality. And the way you feel about that depends on which lane you're driving in. And by the way, once again, Washington State fighting back against Trump. We're going to get to that in a moment. Here to tell us what this means for consumers and for businesses is GeekWire's Monica Nicholsberg. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So the announcement by the FCC went off today almost without a hitch. But
there was
a hitch.
One big hitch, yes. There was a security threat, and it was very dramatic. It was during the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai's remarks. He had to stop abruptly, and they cleared the room, and the Washington Post actually kept their stream up, so we were able to see dogs and security guards clearing it, and then they resumed.
Okay. People feel strongly about this. Can you give us a quick refresher, Monica? The vote to end net neutrality means what?
Well, net neutrality in the simplest terms is a policy that was enacted by Obama's FCC in 2015 that basically says internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon have to treat all internet traffic the same. So if I'm Comcast, I can't tell Google, hey, you can get this really fast internet for your customers if you pay a premium. And I also can't tell Netflix, you know, I really don't like that your video streamer competes with my own product, so I'm going to slow you down so your customers don't like it as much.
So these big internet providers, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, why do they want to slow or block content? Is it about making more money or preferencing their own stuff over somebody else? What?
Well, they say that they're not going to take advantage of the repeal of net neutrality. They say that they don't have any plans to create fast and slow lanes. And, you know, I guess if you believe Comcast, then you're not so scared. And if you don't, then you think that eventually down the line they might start taking advantage of the fact that these rules aren't in place and creating these fast and slow lanes.
Well, that's part of what's amazing to me is that disagreement, that huge disagreement on what this means and what's going to happen. Listen to the FCC commissioner, Ajit Pai, here. This is before he voted in favor of this this deregulation.
It is time for the internet once again to be driven by engineers and entrepreneurs and consumers rather than lawyers and accountants and bureaucrats. It is time for us to act to bring faster, better, and cheaper internet access to all Americans. It is time for us to return to the bipartisan regulatory framework under which the internet flourished prior to 2015. It is time for us to restore internet freedom.
Wow, freedom and flourishing, that sounds good. But this is fellow FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn seeing it differently in dissent.
I dissent from this spirally spun, legally lightweight, consumer harming, corporate enabling, destroying internet freedom order.
GeekWire's Monica Nicholsberg, help me. Who wins and who loses here? What do you think?
Do you mean who wins based on the vote?
Well, if net neutrality being repealed, we have these two very different versions of how it's all going to work out. And so I want to know what you think. How's it going to work out? We could split this up between consumers and businesses. Let's say, so I'm a consumer. I'm at home. I'm watching Netflix. How does it work out for me, do we think?
If the big telecom companies don't keep their word and do decide to prioritize some traffic over others, then the way that you would feel it probably would be like your video would be slow as a consumer. If you're trying to start a small business, then you all of a sudden have to compete with huge companies who can pay for better service, and you probably don't have the funds to do that. So that means you get slower service, and that can kind of hinder your ability to take off, particularly if you rely heavily on the internet. Your customers aren't going to want to use a product that runs slowly.
And every business uses the internet. So are we talking to small startup tech companies, internet companies, or are we talking about small business in general that, you know, everybody has a website and the little guys lose?
I'm a firm believer that every company is a tech company these days. So I think anybody who relies on the internet in any way is going to be affected if these telecom companies don't keep their word. I want to keep stressing that because they have put out strong statements that they're not going to take advantage of this. But
yeah.
I think that when you see the overwhelming open internet advocates saying that they you know, overwhelmingly that they don't believe that the internet's going to remain the way it is today.
Well, you know who's been saying they don't like this for years is Microsoft, Amazon, But those are giants. They can afford. They're the big guys. They can pay to fast stream their videos or whatever they want. So why were they trying so hard to keep net neutrality?
Well, I think just because you can pay for something doesn't mean you want to.
That's fair.
And these companies do spin out a lot of startups, and I think they do have a vested interest in the innovation economy. But beyond that, you know, people who supported rolling back net neutrality would tell you that a company like Google and Facebook has an unfair advantage in the marketplace because they're not subject to the same regulations as a Verizon or a Comcast, which is regulated more like a utility.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about what happens now in reaction, because our Washington Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, says once again he plans to sue. There's a Republican lawmaker who wants Washington State to enforce our own net neutrality rules. Forget the feds. We're going to enforce net neutrality here. How would that work?
Yeah, this is a really interesting part of the story. So yesterday, Governor Jay Inslee gave a press conference, and he said that he's going to create a de facto net neutrality certification program in Washington. So he's going to instruct the utilities department to create a certification that internet companies can get if they meet certain principles and uphold net neutrality standards. And without that certification, he says he's going to make it really hard for them to do business in Washington, everything from government easements to using public utility poles. So that's fascinating, but the FCC did account for states trying to create their own piecemeal legislation and regulations, and they said in no uncertain terms in the legislation, in the policy that they passed and also in their comments today, that they are going to crack down on states trying to do this.
They saw you coming, Bob Ferguson,
yes.
And maybe they headed Washington State off at the pass. We don't know.
And Bob Ferguson, we should say, also this morning announced that he plans to file a lawsuit about the decision with other attorneys general across the country.
Okay, so it could be overturned that way. I heard about maybe a proposal in Washington State being that there's a Washington State internet speed test. And I imagine that maybe the state would make it real easy for you to, I don't know, maybe there's a number on your screen just showing you visually, viscerally, your streaming is being slowed down.
Right. And that would help with the enforcement of this statewide net neutrality that Inslee announced yesterday. And then they're also considering more seriously municipal broadband, otherwise internet that's run by the government as if it were a public utility.
Okay. Well, again, we've been talking about the FCC move today, voting on party lines to undo the Obama-era net neutrality rules meant to give equal access to the internet. And as you pointed out, Monica, the big providers, the internet service providers, the telecom companies, they say we're not going to make this Lexus lanes on the internet. So we'll see how it works out. Monica Nicholsberg from GeekWire, Seattle's tech news site. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So those net neutrality supporters, including Washington State, say they're going to sue. In Olympia, there's some legislation introduced on this. Legislative session starts on January 8th. This is The Record on KUOW. And we're going to talk about toll lanes of another kind. We're going to get more literal with this. The idea that maybe tolls on Seattle area roadways, maybe those tolls are not high enough. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Now, you probably love sitting in traffic because it means more time with KUOW. I'm just assuming here. I suppose it could be that you can't stand the minutes, the many minutes, the hours and hours that traffic just seems to siphon from your life. Either way, are you willing to pay to get out of traffic? And how much should you pay? A new report from the University of Minnesota finds that for the express toll lanes here on 405 to work better, the current maximum toll of $10 needs to go up. Our guest is Ed Berry, Director of Tolling with the Washington State Department of Transportation. Welcome, Ed.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
The state of Washington asked this expert panel from Minnesota to weigh in. So the panel says $10 is not enough on the 405 toll lanes. Why would that be?
They had a few recommendations, and that was one of them. I think they think that could be a solution in concert with some others, but it's just one of many that we're taking under advisement to analyze and see what's possible.
Okay, one of many. Let's talk about this one. Why more than $10? Why would that be better?
Well, I think they think that by raising it, it could help move more traffic through the express toll lanes. I think that's their conclusion. But again, that's not under the purview of the DOT. That's something the Transportation Commission would have to take under advisement after some analysis and some contemplation.
Wouldn't higher tolls mean fewer people in the toll lanes? It would keep people out of the toll lanes, wouldn't it?
I think that's the university's recommendation. Yeah. I think that's their thinking.
Yeah. So if the fast lanes are being overused now, because under this theory, the $10 toll, it doesn't always hit $10, but sometimes it reaches that maximum. If that's not enough, then that means drivers don't mind going in that toll lane. They'd rather pay the $10 and use the toll lane, and that's clogging the toll lane. The fast lane isn't fast enough. My first question is, isn't this good news for all the other drivers? So if you're a solo driver, you want the tolls selfishly. You want the tolls to be low so that people drive in all the lanes and don't clog your solo lane. Is that right?
Well, I think you want the express toll lane to move as quickly as it can so you have that option when you need a faster trip. I think that's what people want as a single occupant. When they need that faster trip, they like to have that choice. So I think that's what we're seeing.
Right. If they're willing, the solo driver who's willing to move over wants to have a fast option. Okay, on our Facebook page, a KOW listener says, higher tolls send the message that, quote, only the rich deserve to spend more time with their families at home. Let the poor people deal with traffic. Is that fair?
Well, I don't think so. I think we're seeing that, when drivers really need that faster trip, I think people see a value in that. I don't think you see people using it every day consistently. I think people use it when they really need a faster trip. And I think that's what we're hearing from a lot of drivers in our surveys, is that people understand and like the option of having that faster trip when they really need it. So I think it's across all demographics. When people really need it, I think people see value there.
A Washington State representative, a Republican Mark Harmsworth from Mill Creek, tweeted out the Minnesota report and called the 405 tolls a failure. Are the 405 tolls a failure?
No, we don't think so. We think they're a success, and we think they're out there doing what they're designed to do and performing well, providing that option for a faster trip. So we definitely think they're a success.
Well, Representative Harmsworth is saying he wants the express toll lanes to go away and just have it go back to general purpose lanes. How would opening all of 405 to be general purpose lanes, how would that affect traffic?
Well, I don't know. Opening them to general purpose lanes or a conversion back to HOV, I think with all the growth that we've seen happening out here, and we've had the good fortune in our area to have such a booming economy and have such great traffic growth, but it does affect the way these express toll lanes operate. So despite all that growth, we think the express toll lanes are really providing that faster trip. Would it be worse converted back? We think it will. If it was converted back to an HOV lane with general purpose lanes, we think it would perform worse, and people would see longer trips. There wouldn't be an option for a faster trip for single occupants. So we like to see the express toll lanes continue out there to provide that faster trip.
You'd like that. What about your customers? What are drivers saying about how they feel the 405 tolls are working?
Well, this past summer, we did a couple surveys where we were asking not only Good2Go customers, but also, account holders, but also 405 drivers up and down the corridor. And we're seeing that over two-thirds majority do like having a faster trip. Over 60% like the option of having a faster trip. So we're seeing some of our customers really see the value there.
There's another recommendation from this Minnesota study, which is for the toll rate to change more frequently. So you might jump in at $4, but when traffic gets really bad, the toll goes up to 8, 10, more. What does the State Transportation Department think about that recommendation?
Well, I think we heard a couple things about that. They wanted the algorithm to be more responsive to react more quickly as congestion builds. And the DOT, we're already considering that. We understand that, and we think that's a valid and good recommendation. So we're trying to understand that and make our existing algorithm more responsive to that. Some of the other recommendation had to do with segment tolling and perhaps breaking it down into different segments to price them differently. We will definitely consider that, but we definitely want to make sure that drivers and customers understand the price they're going to pay.
Yeah, if the price changes too fast, then like, wait a second, I can't get out fast enough to not pay the higher toll that I don't want to pay.
Yeah, we want customers to definitely know what they're going to pay to the destination that they're going to go to. And I think the University of Minnesota clarified that today, that's their intention as well. But they definitely want us to consider a more consideration about different segments to help manage that toll buy decision a little bit tighter. So we'll definitely consider that.
We asked listeners how they feel about the 405 toll lanes, and Lorraine says they work great between Bellevue and Kirkland, where there are two express lanes. You can use the left side on and off ramps, so the express traffic doesn't have to merge in and out of the general purpose lanes. But she says the Bothell section, not so good. There's no left side access, and Lorraine says people, they jump the double or quadruple white line from a dead stop in the general lane into the high-speed toll lane. So dangerous, says Lorraine. What do you think?
Well, we definitely don't want to see that kind of behavior out there. And we do want to make sure that people are being safe out there when they use the express toll lane. So we understand that, and we want to make sure that the express toll lanes are enforced to not only have a safe trip, but also to have that faster trip for people who really want to use it. And we know that single lane section does struggle more than the double lane section. And we're talking amongst ourselves and with legislators on the best ways to perhaps address that. And in the northbound direction, there's a PQ shoulder that has been offering relief since April. So we're happy about the performance that we're seeing in the northbound single lane section. So we see that as a success as well.
Speaking of high tolls, it was big news this week when in suburban D.C., an interstate toll spiked at $40. Could that ever happen here? We're talking again about this panel of experts says $10 not enough. Could $40 happen?
Well, the express toll lanes as they operate now, the toll rate cap is under the purview of policy and commission. Commission purview. So I won't speculate on what's possible in the future. I just think we should concentrate on the recommendations that we're seeing out of this study. And we think there's a lot of good recommendations here to make them operate well.
Can I quote you as not ruling out $40?
The toll cap is not under the state's purview.
Okay.
So we're not considering $40, no.
Okay, the Highway 99 tunnel tolls, that tunnel is coming, 2019 or something? And it's estimated to be at something like $2.50. Why so low comparatively?
Well, it's two different facilities.
Yeah.
The 99 tunnel is being told to pay back some of the financial obligations to bond and to pay back the tunnel. So that's a different situation than dynamic tolling on an express toll lane, which purpose for that is to manage traffic and to provide that faster trip on an express toll lane. So they're being told for different reasons, and that's why you see some of the differences there.
And if the tolls are too high in the tunnel, then presumably drivers would say, nope, not buying, and then now they're downtown clogging things up.
Well, yeah, the mission of the commission in setting toll rates is to pay back the financial obligations of the tunnel, but also to keep, you know, the tunnel tolls, you know, as low as they can to make it operate efficiently.
Okay, we've been talking with the director of tolling with the Washington State Transportation Department. That's Ed Berry talking about this University of Minnesota panel of outside experts saying maybe the 405 express toll lanes need to go higher and other recommendations as well. And we'll keep talking about this for sure. Ed, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. Join the conversation on KUOW's Facebook page. How's it going out there, I-405 drivers? Are express toll lanes making your life worse, better, no change? How could higher tolls affect you? Join us on KUOW's Facebook page for that conversation. And once you get past the tolls into the city, you know there's a good chance you're going to cross a bridge. Next up, we have a writer who spent a summer sitting inside a bridge tower. She's got thoughts about the water and the people who flow in of Seattle and out of Seattle. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. 1,000 people move to Seattle every week. That has made rents climb. It's made longtime residents leave. One of those people who left is Alyssa Washuta. I met her on the show last summer. She was an advisor in the UW's American Indian Studies Department. She's a member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, and she was the writer-in-residence for the Fremont Bridge. She sat in the tower above the water and looked out over a city remade in a new image.
I started thinking about the process of dredging and the way that the water came in to fill that. And immediately, Lake Washington's water level dropped about 9 feet. And then slowly, over a little bit of time, it dropped 20 feet. The Black River dried up. And so my, you know, gazing out upon the ship canal began to be sort of imbued with all of these thoughts about the destruction that had happened, the displacement of Duwamish people, Duwamish villages that had been along the Black River, that happened as a result of the creation of the ship canal.
After a summer spent writing about displacement, Alyssa has moved on herself, ironically, to the capital of Ohio, named after Christopher Columbus. We might talk about that. Alyssa, welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
Thanks for visiting us again. During your residency on the Fremont Bridge, which, by the way, is such a lovely image of
it,
you.
It was. It was amazing.
Amazing. You wrote this essay on the birth of Seattle as we currently know it. Would you mind reading an excerpt of that? Do you have that handy?
Yeah, I'd love to. Before this place was Seattle, it was steep hills bent all over rivers, tide flats, lakes, bogs, spirit powers, forests, people, longhouses, prairies, and other pieces of place tied together in a system of regular fluctuation and movement. Then the Bostons, the word my great-grandmother and lots of other people up and down this coast used for white men, came and wanted to put their progress into the land. The Boston men turned places into property. Terminals, shipyards, mills, railroad beds, dumps, cesspools, homesteads, parks, streets, wharves, trestles, bridges, canals. The Boston men dredged, regraded, dumped, removed, sanitized, engineered, straightened, renamed, mined, seized, settled, procreated. Where they saw useless, unsightly, progress-impeding land and water, they imagined real estate. Navigable waters, land to build upon.
You write about how all of this affected the people who were already here, people living here and hunting and fishing and playing, living life.
Yes.
And how did this displacement, how did it affect your family?
So I am Coast Salish. I'm, again, a member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe and a Cascade descendant. So our ancestral territory is in southwestern Washington. So I'm not Duwamish. I'm not from the Salish Sea. So I don't speak for the Duwamish people. But we had very similar patterns of displacement in some ways. So the Cowlitz Indian Tribe sat down for treaty negotiations in 1855 at the same time that the Duwamish people and other people of the Salish Sea of this region sat down. And the Cowlitz people decided not to sign a treaty because they would have had to sign away their rights to village sites, you know, prairies and fishing places, hunting places, as you mentioned, burial grounds, you know, all these significant places that they had been, you know, inhabiting and using and, you know, working with for more than 10,000 years. So they declined to sign this treaty and were shuttled off to the Quinault Reservation on the coast, not our ancestral land, land that we had to make do with and new neighbors that we had to make do with. And I'm also Cascade. So those villages were along the Columbia River, traditionally around, you know, Celilo Falls area. And in 1856, the Cascade people were removed to Warm Springs, to Grand Ronde, to other places. Some remained along the river. So that history is very similar to the history of the Salish Sea Native peoples in some ways. Because, you know, the Duwamish people, you know, have been here since time immemorial, and around the same time, in the same batch of treaties and attempts at treaty making, some Duwamish people were forced to go to reservations, Muckleshoot, Port Madison, Puyallup, other places. But a lot of Duwamish people chose to remain on their ancestral lands here in what's now Seattle.
Do you fault the white settlers of the Puget Sound area for changing the land in all the ways you described? Does it feel like a crime? Does it feel like progress with winners and losers? What do you make of it?
I acknowledge that what I learned from doing this research as part of the Fremont Bridge process is project is that, you know, what I think is thought of now as kind of I think a lot of people think of this, you know, quote unquote progress in Seattle as having winners and losers and unintended effects on the indigenous people. I don't think that that was the case. I think that the displacement of the Duwamish people was intentional. I mean, when Seattle was originally incorporated, 3 weeks after incorporation, Ordinance 5 was passed, which was an ordinance banning Native people from living in town unless they did so for working for settlers. It's important to me to underscore this idea that displacement was inflicted upon the indigenous people of this land, of, you know, many other places too, and it was intentional. And the settlers, the engineers who drained the Black River and who, undertook the other engineering projects that made Seattle what it is now, they knew that it would lead to indigenous displacement, and they decided that they wanted that to happen.
And at the very beginning, I started talking about all the people moving here and unaffordability and change, mm-hmm. and people coming and going, and you've gone too. How do you compare the displacement by force, as you said, intentional, inflicted in the mid-19th century Seattle? How do you compare that to the, softer displacement of growth, mm-hmm. and home price and lost culture and places?
I've been thinking about this, and, you know, I find it very difficult to compare the two and to, you know, compare, contrast. But I think the way that I am thinking about it is that the project of the United States has always relied upon displacement of the people who were here first. Like, that's how this country was established, through methodical, codified displacement. And so, you know, since that's not only, you know, permissible but necessary for this nation to exist, I think that, you know, makes it continue to seem necessary or like permissible for people who are living in cities to be forced out.
But forced, so you're still using the word forced out, because you write about such a literal forcing, yeah. infliction, and I wonder how you contrast that to people coming and going now.
I mean, I think, so now, you know, and I'm not any kind of expert on, you know, local, like, housing policy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I experienced it as a renter in Seattle for 10 years. But I guess my thought is that what, you know, in the 1850s, this displacement resulted from the needs, you know, perceived needs of settlers. They wanted land. And so the United States government made that happen through treaty making and through other policies that did force Native people out, or, you know, made Native people leave in some way. And so I think, you know, I haven't thought about it that much, you know, like exactly how it works and exactly how I would compare it. But I know that there is, you know, there are, you know, policies that have been implemented that I think could make it easier or harder for people to remain in cities. So I think that it's similarly a sort of joint process between, you know, individual people who want to live here and the governments who put laws in place and enforce laws that have to do with living in a place.
Well, a lot of people can't afford to live in Seattle, people
right.
of all kinds.
I was one of them.
You were one of them. Do you think the city especially owes it to Native people to help them stay home this time, not move to Columbus or wherever they're going?
Yeah, absolutely. I do.
Why?
Because this was originally Native land, and there was a treaty making process in this area in southwestern Washington. You know, there's almost 2 million acres of unceded territory that was taken from the Cowlitz people. So there's, you know, very different relationships to land based on municipality. But, you know, I do think that the United States government and local governments, I do think, have obligations through the government-to-government relationship, through the trust responsibility. They have responsibilities to Native people.
What has it been like to move to when I saw that you had left to go to Columbus, it certainly jumped out at me.
It's weird.
I don't know whether you're way past it or care, but is it, you know, what's it like being, moving to a city named after Christopher Columbus?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely weird. It was definitely disturbing at first. And it's still disturbing, you know, when I type out Columbus. I think what's most disturbing is not the name, although that is, but also just being in a place where, Native people were removed from what's now Ohio so longer ago. And I think there's a sense there that there's less of a presence of Native people. A few people have told me incorrectly that there were never any Native people in Ohio, which is completely untrue. And so I think there's a perception that, you know, that Native people are gone or in the past. It's very different from Seattle.
Yeah. I mean, that's so absurd, but I didn't know that Ohio was so, you know, in Seattle, I think we're so conscious, so aware of our history.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Huh. Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's room for more awareness, but it's certainly more than what I'm experiencing now. But you know, there are quite a few Native people who live in the city of Columbus. I can't remember the number, but you know, in Ohio State, we have an American Indian Studies program, and we have Native faculty there. So there's certainly Native presence in Ohio.
You know, I've heard some Native people say they've got an ethical responsibility to stay on their homelands. Was that a struggle for you?
It was.
I realized you did. You know, you're not. You weren't living in the Columbia. You were already in Seattle.
Right.
But how did you struggle with that?
I did. You know, I grew up in New Jersey, and so I came out here for graduate school in 2007, and you know, that was a conscious decision to come closer to my mother's family and my tribe, and I wanted to get involved in learning more about current Cowlitz governance and just being involved in the tribe. And through my 10 years here, I got involved in, you know, as you said, American Indian Studies at UW. I was an advisor there. I just made lots of friends and had lots of colleagues who are Coast Salish, made a lot of visits out to different people's ancestral territories. And so it was really hard to leave my land. Even though this is not my traditional territory, we share, a trade jargon, Chinook jargon was spoken up and down the coast. Some of our traditions are sort of overlapping. So it was really hard. And I'm definitely aware of the argument that Native people should remain in the homelands. But, you know, I I have to go where I have to go for work. That's basically what it came down to. I hung on here for a long time, and I was on a part-time salary, and took contract work, and was, you know, I think every single night going to sleep, I was doing math in my head about how much longer can I stay during my last year. And I just had to make the decision to look for a job, and to be willing to go wherever I needed to, basically, in order to make rent.
Mm. So Alyssa grew up in New Jersey, ancestors from southwest part of Washington State. You're living in Seattle, and you're up on the Fremont Bridge, mm-hmm. and you're looking at the straightened, dredged, sluiced, drained Seattle. Can you ever feel at home?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
when do you feel at home?
I'm really happy to be back here. It definitely feels like home. And I think I thought going to Ohio that I would never be able to return. What's that? I don't remember who wrote "You Can Never Go Home Again," but that's how I felt. I have several homes now. My New Jersey is home in some ways. In every way, and Seattle is home in every way, and now Ohio is becoming home. I can look at, I guess the process of looking at the ship canal was more of doing the work of actually trying to adjust how I saw it. Because before I did any research on what happened with the ship canal and Lake Washington and everything, I would walk over the ship canal all the time going from the university to Madison Park, where I used to live several years ago. So I, doing that project was doing the work of re-envisioning it and seeing it as a human-made waterway that had whose creation had dramatic effects on the landscape. But as far as the question of home goes, I feel at home here still, and I see it changing, and it's definitely changed since I left in July, but it's still home. New Jersey's still home, and Ohio's home too.
Alyssa, welcome back home.
Thank you.
Alyssa Washuta was an advisor in the UW's American Indian Studies Department when we met her a year ago or so, last summer, and now she's an assistant professor of creative writing at Ohio State University.
Yes.
Welcome back home. Thanks for visiting.
Thanks for having me.
Alyssa Washuta on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be back in just a moment with more of The Record. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. There's no water, no birds, no bison, no muskrats. People can't get through to their hunting grounds or sacred sites. Those are the words of Melody Lapine, a member of the Mixo Cree First Nation. She's describing the Peace River downstream from a proposed hydroelectric dam in British Columbia. Her tribe says the dam would dry up the river even further. And the tribe had reason for hope. The BC government that started that project got voted out of office this year. Well, this week we found out what the new BC government will do. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, welcome.
Hello, Bill. The new government disappointed a lot of supporters this week. They said the project is past the point of no return. They are going to complete the big hydro dam on the Peace River.
And you call this the first big decision from BC's new Democratic Party government. What do you mean?
Well, they've been government since the summer. A lot of the stuff they've done so far was keeping promises they made during the election, taking the tolls off the big bridges around Vancouver and increasing funding for the disabled and people on social assistance. Popular decisions. But this one, they said this project needed a review. They submitted it to a review. They said if the review came up negative, they would kill the project, but they concluded that on balance, it would be cheaper to finish it, better for the provincial economy and government finances than killing it. The problem they had, Bill, is that it had been under construction for more than 2 years. They'd already spent $2 billion canceling the contracts and remediating the site and putting it back the way they found it would have cost another $2 billion, so you'd have a $4 billion write-off, Canadian, of course, with nothing to show for it. Confronted with all that, they decided, we're stuck, we're going to finish it.
The Premier, John Horgan, said, this is not a project we would have started. We do it with a heavy heart.
Yeah, he said that, and I mean, some of his own supporters aren't taking that with much good grace, but it's a new government. I think what you will see is that an awful lot of the people that supported the government will be happy with a lot of the other things they do, and the next election could be 4 years away, and you know how the voters sometimes forget things between now and the next election. So the government is going to move on, and I think their supporters will. But it's a very controversial decision. You quoted the First Nations concerns this morning. Again, some of the environmental impact and the impact on communities here has to be put into perspective. There are already two huge hydroelectric dams on that river, so a lot of the damage has already been done. It's not a free-running river like some of the rivers in British Columbia, the Fraser being a good example.
Is this the end, Vaughn, or will these First Nations and other environmentalists, will they keep fighting?
They say they will keep fighting, and they will go back to court and try to stop it. Now, so far, there have been 14 court cases against this project, and the opponents have lost, at the end of the day, every single one of them. So their record of stopping it in court isn't good. I think the more likely outcome is that you will see negotiations where the First Nations, whose traditional territory has been damaged by this project, will get some sort of economic compensation, perhaps jobs, perhaps remediation, perhaps land elsewhere. Six of British Columbia's First Nations have already made those kinds of deals, and I think that's probably what the future holds, is compensation rather than stopping the project outright.
Talking about the Site C dam on the giant Peace River, this dam would be a hydroelectric project in British Columbia, and there's opposition coming from all the way far to the east, downstream, and among others. And that's Vaughn Palmer telling you about it, Vancouver Sun columnist. Vaughn, thanks for filling us in.
Bye-bye, Bill.
In the fall of 1973, the democratically elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende, was overthrown in a violent coup. That event changed the course of many people's lives, including the life of Beatriz Alvarez. Her grandson, Diego Villarroel, tells the story for KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media.
In 1973, my grandmother was attending university in Chile on her way to becoming a history teacher. She and her family were avid supporters of Salvador Allende. My grandma's brother, Alfonso, was even a part of a large political movement that supported him. Then on the morning of September 11th, my grandmother was listening to the radio as Allende addressed the people of Chile. A few hours later, Allende was dead. Allende's family later confirmed he committed suicide rather than give himself up, but many Chileans don't accept that, like my grandmother.
They say he killed himself, but it wasn't true. They kill him.
The military began to arrest people who weren't loyal to the new government. A family friend of theirs was arrested and tortured. Then they came for my grandma's brother, Alfonso. The police surrounded the whole neighborhood to get to him.
He wasn't not even home. He went out with a girlfriend, but they made a really good show to get him, like he was so dangerous.
They arrested Alfonso, but my grandmother didn't know where they took him. And because of the coup, she had to drop out of university. So she spent the next week searching for her brother. Eventually, she found him. He was put into jail about 30 minutes away from her home. Every day for a year, my grandmother would ride her green lowrider bike to bring her brother lunch and keep him company. Then one day, he got a new cellmate. He was a political prisoner too. His name was Miguel. Miguel and Alfonso became quick friends. And my grandma liked him too. She thought he was well-spoken and handsome.
After the we was talking for a few months, it got more interesting.
There were always family members visiting the jail, so before long, she also met Miguel's mother.
But I think at that time we already started going together, when I met the mother.
What do you mean by going together?
I mean, just be together in the same, when I go and visit my brother, he coming over, we sit there and talk and all those things. It wasn't all about my brother anymore. It was about Miguel too.
She even had her first kiss in the jail.
In front of everybody. That was embarrassing. My parents, everybody sees you.
Oh, your parents were there?
My father, they all would go and visit my brother.
My grandmother would bring Miguel candy, and Miguel began to write little notes on the wrappers. And whenever leaves would fall into his cell, he would write little notes on them too. And eventually, the leaves and miscellaneous wrappers couldn't hold enough space to express their feelings. So my grandma started hiding a small notebook in the basket of food she would bring, and they would secretly trade it back and forth every day.
Do you want to start with the date?
This is October 11, 1974. Hacía tiempo que no sentía ganas de llorar.
For the longest time, I didn't feel the need to cry. But today I have to hold back the tears so they don't fall down my face. I can feel the heaviness of the jail on my shoulders because I can't hold you in my arms.
Al no poder estrecharte, entre mis brazos.
I remember your smile,
recuerdo
your face,
tu risa,
your voice.
Cara, tu voz, Miguel.
I flip through these notebooks now, and within them sit dried and crumbling leaves marked with faded pen, flowers and folded up wrappers left forgotten between the pages. And there are three more notebooks just like this.
Do you want to read what you wrote back?
No.
No?
October 12, 1974. ¿Cuántas lágrimas dura de al... ¿Cuántas
How many tears I cried today? I can't recall. But who cares about that? Because I love you and that make me strong. Nothing will never be as magnificent as you. Como tú.
My grandma continued to visit and write to Miguel until about a year later, Miguel called my grandma up and said they were letting him go. So she went down to the jail and walked him home. A few months later, in her hometown of San Felipe, they got married. Her whole family was there. Even her brother came from jail with an armed escort. Everything that my grandma cared for was in Chile, but it wasn't safe for the man she loved. They applied for refugee status, and a few months later, left everything behind for a new life in Seattle.
My parents went to take me to the airport. All my brother and sister, they all went with me. Was sad. I was the first one to leave the country. And then was hard. But that was the only way.
My grandma and Miguel were living together in Seattle for almost 20 years and had a house of their own. They raised two kids, my tía and my dad. So that means Miguel was my grandfather. But things didn't work out for them. Eventually, they got divorced. And years later, my grandpa Miguel passed away. Now, my grandma lives near me in Edmonds, Washington. Her parents and brothers and sisters are scattered around the world. She never became a history teacher like she wanted, but she works as a program assistant at a local community college. And she's married again to my grandpa Julian, who was good friends with my grandpa Miguel. Are you guys happy?
Yeah, at least I am. I don't know him.
Yes, I am happy. I enjoyed, you know.
They've been together almost 25 years now. So, I mean, he is my grandpa. And he's always taking care of me, just like he promised my grandpa Miguel.
Daniel told you this. The last day before he died, he called and I talked to him. And he told me, you know, can you please take care of Diego? I said, of course.
My grandma sacrificed so much for love. She lost her family, her country, and her dreams of being a teacher to be with the man she loved. That love ended. But it didn't have to last forever for it to mean something. And there's always a chance to find it again. For Radioactive, I'm Diego Villarreal.
And you'll find more youth-produced stories on KUOW's Radioactive podcast and connect with us on Radioactive's Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. That's it for The Record on KUOW Today, put together by Amin Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. If you come back tomorrow, you'll hear the week's news reviewed. The Week in Review has Joni Balter tomorrow and Rob McKenna and Erica C. Barnett. I'm Bill Radke. We're looking forward to that. I hope you'll tune in. Thanks for listening.